Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, March 6, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group telephone conference call and our discussion of the new book by Shane Harris, At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. As we've done in the past, we're going to proceed with an interview format today. So we welcome not only our author, but Paul Rosenzweig as well. Paul is the principal at Red Branch Law and Consulting and the former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. He's also an author himself of several books and at least one forthcoming book we were just discussing. He'll be joined, of course, by Shane Harris. He's a senior correspondent of the Daily Beast and the ASU Future of War Fellow at New America. And he's also the author of our topic today, the new book, At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. And just a quick note, a link to that book, the Amazon page anyhow, is available in the information we circulated in advance of today's call, so please use that link if you'd like to buy a copy of the book. As I mentioned, we're going to proceed with an interview format, but as always, we're going to be looking to our audience for your questions, so please do be ready with those questions. And with that, Mr. Rosenzweig, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean. Thanks for having us. My name is Paul Rosenzweig, and I am joined today by Shane Harris, the author of the new book, At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. This is Shane's second book. His earlier book, The Watchers, was equally well-received, and we're very pleased to be joined by you, Shane, today to talk about your book. Thanks for coming on board.
Thanks, Paul. It's good to talk with you, and thanks to the Federalist Society for having me.
Good deal. So my first question to you is very simple. How come you nowhere in your new book mention me?
Because everyone has already read all of the very wise and profound things that you have to say on this topic, Paul, and they would be learning nothing new from my book if they saw you there.
Well, of course. Thanks for that. No. So let's start with some real questions, and I'll start with some kind of relatively broad ones, and then we'll hone down a bit.
Okay.
So here's a first broad one. What was the most surprising or interesting or unusual thing you learned in preparing this book and writing it that was something that nobody knew before or that you didn't know and that you think would be interesting, unusual, or surprising for the listeners to learn about?
Sure. Well, it's a great question, and my answer immediately pops to mind, which is that I don't think I appreciated the extent to which the private sector had not only assumed that the government is not protecting their networks and their computers from hackers, from spies, and from people who want to do damage to them, but has already moved ahead quite significantly to try and protect itself, whether that be in the form of new startups, tech startups, that in the private cyber defense space that are some of the biggest IPOs actually of the past few years, the ways in which companies are just themselves even contemplating whether or not they have a right of self-defense, you might call it, in cyberspace, and the ability to hack back at the people who are stealing from them to try and retrieve trade secrets or other intellectual property that was stolen. I knew that there was a private defense industry out there that was growing up. I didn't realize the extent to which so many companies have kind of already internalized the fact that to a large degree they're on their own when it comes to protecting their data, and that there's not going to be somebody riding in on a white horse from NSA or the Homeland Security Department to fend off the Chinese or the Russians or the North Koreans from their networks.
What accounts for that? What did you discover accounts for that? Is it lack of resources, lack of political will, lack of capacity, lack of interest? Why is it that that's the case?
It's many of those things. I mean, for starters, there is a question about resources. I mean, the government cannot simply protect, you know, all of the networks in the United States. When 85% of our internet infrastructure is privately owned, it's the vast majority of it's going to be, you know, beyond the capabilities of the government to protect it. Now, that hasn't stopped some senior officials from trying to more actively protect very critical networks in the U.S. and sometimes with to great controversy. You know, I write in the book about how when Keith Alexander, General Alexander, was the head of the NSA, he had a meeting with financial services executives in New York and proposed to allow the agency to install monitoring equipment on financial networks in the United States, which sort of struck people in the room with him as one of the most preposterous ideas they'd heard. It was just way too controversial, and why would they let a government agency like that into their networks? But there's also, you know, I found that there's a question of, you know, some degree political will to do that. I mean, obviously, a lot of these are private companies, and they are clearly resistant in many cases to having the government come in and be too intrusive. It's almost as if they want, you know, they want the government ideally to provide them with intelligence and information about the bad guys they should be looking out for, but they don't necessarily want them in the networks, you know, trying to fend them off. The most telling anecdote I can recall from this, where you had sort of almost though a disconnect about this issue. Back in 2012, there was a series of big, what are called denial of service attacks, like traffic flooding attacks on websites owned by major banks in the U.S. And this was a really sophisticated attack. It was later attributed to forces in Iran. And what really scared the banks and scared people in government, too, was the volume of information. DDoS attacks like this are pretty common, but this was a really big one, sort of a tsunami, if you like. And executives did go to the Homeland Security Department and essentially said, what are you going to do about this? And I interviewed one person who was in charge of cyber policy at DHS at the time, who looked at them and said, what do you expect us to do? You mean you want us to go to war with Iran? Do you want us to take military action against them? There's not much that we can do in this case. And that, I think, was one of those moments where it was starting to key into people in business, at least that I talked to, that even for really valuable networks and even in really sort of dire kind of crisis modes, like a very big denial of service attack, there was no guarantee that the government was going to step in and try to mitigate that or help the companies recover from it.
So that leaves them on their own then. So tell us a little bit about that. That's highly controversial, obviously, both as a matter of law, and you're talking to a bunch of lawyers today, and as a matter of policy. To what extent do you think that that's actually happening? Is it happening underneath the undercover, so to speak, or are people being pretty overt about it?
Well, if we're talking about hacking back, or what the military sort of name for it is, active defense, you know, I think it is happening, but very, very quietly. I interviewed one former senior intelligence official for the book who was very explicit, saying, you know, hacking back is happening. In his opinion, it is illegal, and that's the opinion of a lot of lawyers I interviewed, but that he felt that in the cases that he was aware of, that it was being done judiciously and probably with the assistance of people not located in the United States. Bloomberg has actually done some reporting on this in recent months about banks, major banks that are believed to, I think in response to the 2012 event I was just describing, to try to launch some retaliatory attack, if you want to call them attacks, but efforts to sort of go out and try and put down the servers that are coming at them. So I do think it is happening. And what was fascinating to me in this sort of theoretical discussion about hacking back is, you know, is there sort of a self-defense principle at play here? You know, if you break into my house, I think most states would recognize that I have a right to self-defense, and in many states even potentially lethal self-defense if you're in my home. But if you come into my home and steal my television set, and then I go find where you are, and I can see my television set through your window, do I have a right to recover that? Now, I would go to law enforcement to do that, obviously, and point you out as the man who stole property from me, but that's not really a practical matter necessarily for these companies. You're not going to get the FBI to necessarily go back in and steal back your trade secrets. So there has been this really vigorous and lively debate about whether or not companies do have some rights when it comes to hacking back that are sort of in the ambit of self-defense. And I'm not a lawyer and not steeped enough into traditions, but I was persuaded that there's at least a legitimate debate and conversation to be had about that, and also persuaded that it's already happening to some degree.
Okay, well,
the actual hacking back.
That's great. Let's shift a bit to a slightly different topic. For me, I think that what was most surprising was to learn the degree and extent to which cyber operations have actually been incorporated in military efforts. You tell a great story about the development of this in Iraq, and I assume that it's being applied as well elsewhere around the globe today, Afghanistan, for example. Tell us a little bit about the development of that and whether or not that's a useful development or one that we should be troubled by.
Yeah, I think the book opens with a discussion of this and telling stories about what happened in the surge in 2007 and 2008 in Iraq. We're all familiar with the fact that President Bush sent tens of thousands of additional combat forces into Iraq for the primary purpose of putting down the insurgency and also trying to stop Iraq from spiraling into a civil war at the time. What was less known is that there was a parallel, really a tandem effort by the National Security Agency working with our Joint Special Operations Forces on the ground to essentially own the networks, the communications networks of Iraq. The NSA developed capability to intercept all phone calls, text messages, and emails that were being sent in Iraq. And analysts on the ground use that information, that metadata, that's the term that we're so familiar with right now, to map out the networks of insurgents and bomb makers and their financiers, particularly including outside Iraq, and handed that information off to ground forces who then could follow up on those leads and go find the people who were actually responsible for the insurgency and who were fueling it. And this kind of cycle of gathering intelligence, feeding it to people on the ground, getting more intelligence from their captured phones, their computers, and putting it kind of back into that cycle, actually ended up, in the view of people I talked to, as being sort of the lever that finally gave us the upper hand over the insurgency and led to what was, at least for the moment anyway, a victory, I think, in the surge. And I love this example because it was sort of, you know, kind of a case in point of when we say cyber warfare, what do we actually mean? Are we talking, we're not necessarily talking about people sitting behind computers and trying to shoot each other with ones and zeros. We're talking about grabbing intelligence and using that in a real-world battlefield kind of context. And I think that's kind of how the evolution of this is going. In the future, the military is trying to incorporate cyber alongside what they call kinetic action, so ground forces, air forces, naval forces. And the ideal, I think, for the military would be that the cyber guys will not be seen as some kind of outlier in the future, but as a component of the total arsenal that the military brings to bear whenever they're fighting a war.
Mm-hmm. So that actually leads me to one of the questions that kind of puzzled me from the book, which is that I have a sense of almost schizophrenia. On the one hand, you paint a picture of an NSA and a military with immense cyber capabilities. You've just described a huge amount of them already. And on the other hand, you paint an NSA that is incapable of defending the network. I'm missing something, but what reconciles those two? Why is it that this military that is so and this capability that is so powerful in identifying threat actors in Iraq isn't useful in defending the banks?
Well, I think that's a great example of why in cyberspace the advantage always goes to the offense, right? And we see this, you know, this the case in point of that is, you know, the degree to which the NSA and others do find it difficult to defend against all of the threats that are out there. You know, if you're an offensive actor in cyberspace, you have the advantage of surprise, of being covert. If you can find weaknesses in your adversary's networks that they don't know about, you're going to be able to take advantage of that and launch kind of surprise attacks. And we should remember, too, that, you know, in Iraq you had, you know, a very closed system, if you like. I mean, this was a place where the U.S. military had occupied the country. The networks in that country were fairly new. These were new cell phone networks, new internet networks. There were hardly as many people, as many users as you would have certainly in the United States. So there, I think it was, I mean, to some degree, a more manageable challenge for the agency. And we should also, you know, emphasize, too, that in the United States, the NSA is principally responsible for defending government networks in the military and the intel community, and then providing intelligence that can be used by the private sector, so they're not out there actively necessarily defending private networks. But they are, you know, constantly having to stay one step ahead of their adversaries here as well. And that's true for companies. It's true for the Homeland Security Department, which does the civilian side. I just think it's the case that the advantage always goes to the offense in cyberspace.
So does that suggest then that the right strategy, if we're concerned about the cyber domain, is to unleash the NSA? If the offense always wins, should we not go on the offense?
Well, I think that there are that can be an appealing idea if we were at the point of hackers sort of overrunning our critical infrastructure networks and, you know, threatening to turn the lights off and kind of cause, you know, a cyber Armageddon. I don't think we're there right now. Now, I do think that if we were at the point where our adversaries were launching attacks of that scale, you would see the agency and the military kind of brought into bear. But no, I think that the more practical and frankly manageable strategy, both in terms of dealing with the threat and also preserving, you know, our open society and our values, is to educate companies on how to do a better job defending their networks. I mean, so many of the attacks, and you hear this repeatedly from experts in this field, that are being launched against, you know, corporations in this country, the kind of espionage that's going on principally by the Chinese, is the result in many cases of companies just not having, you know, even basic security on their systems. We saw this with the Sony hack. I mean, this was not a sophisticated attack by North Korea to get inside Sony's networks. It used fairly standard operating procedure for getting in. You know, why is it that a multinational digital media company like Sony does not have a more basic and just more robust understanding of cybersecurity? I mean, I think that's where the problem really lies.
Is it education or is it a lack of economic incentive?
I think it's actually probably more lack of economic incentive. I mean, you know, the education, the learning curve may be steep for some of these companies, but by now, if you were the CEO of a major corporation in this country right now and you don't understand that you're at risk, you're just not paying attention. Like, you haven't read a newspaper in the past year and a half. It was interesting. I've been having, as a separate project, discussions with a number of folks who work in the utilities field, so managing electrical power plants, water plants, and the like, and talking to people at the level who are physically managing facilities, you know, where you have the actual work of producing and distributing electricity being done. And we've known for a long time that these plants use what are known as industrial control systems, or computers that help regulate the machinery and regulate the flow of electricity, and that many of these systems are connected to the internet and therefore are vulnerable to being hacked and manipulated. Even knowing that, the people I talk to will say that it is difficult for them to persuade the executives in their companies that they should be spending more on cybersecurity when there are so many physical security issues. There's plant maintenance, there's putting fences up around the perimeter, there's protecting against weather, and protecting against squirrels getting into, you know, power facilities, things that every day are causing all kinds of disruptions to electrical power generation and distribution in the U.S. that have nothing to do with hackers. And it's been a real challenge for them to say to their boss, is, look, you really ought to spend more money on upgrading this, and it's not going to be cheap, on the off chance that a foreign government or a group of hackers decides they want to take out a power grid, which is a remote possibility. Even the Director of National Intelligence said that 2 weeks ago. So there's a real economic pitch that is hard for them to make, I think.
Yeah, you are aware of the squirrel theory of electric grid safety, aren't you? There have been more outages attributed to squirrels than to cyber.
Yeah. It's true.
So we drifted away from the war piece before I kind of we finished plumbing the depths of it. One of the ongoing debates is kind of the organization of the military to exercise cyber force, both in terms of its setting up a cyber command that's independent of the general combatant command, and in terms of that cyber command also being dual-hatted and run by the NSA director. Did you come away with an opinion about whether or not our current organizational structure is right? After all, in Washington, we always like to rearrange the wire diagrams.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think I did come away persuaded by the opinion of a number of senior officials, including, I believe, General Hayden, Mike Hayden, who used to run the NSA, that dual-hatting that position of NSA director and cybercom commander is not the right idea, that it's too much authority to be placed in one individual, one agency. There's too much of a conflict between the defensive and the offensive missions. There's a conflict between the military and the intelligence missions. I've written this before. I think that Admiral Rogers, who serves currently in that dual headed position, may well be the last one to do so. There was a recommendation on the table about a year or so ago to the president to consider splitting that position. He ultimately didn't go down that road, but I don't sense that there's any hostility within the administration to the idea. I think they just decided it was too soon, given the relative lack of maturity of Cyber Command, to split it up and put it on its own. But I think that is generally the direction where we're going, and I think that's smart. I mean, we should have our intelligence agencies like NSA conducting intelligence missions and operations under the law that guides that, and we should have our military in the form of Cyber Command doing what the military does. I think that that's a fair system, and in cyber is the only place where we have been really blurring those authorities and putting all of them under one person.
I get the sense from the book that you came away with a fairly dim view of the management of NSA, and particularly its direction by General Alexander. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes.
Why?
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, I guess my complaint, and it's one that's shared by others too, I guess, with General Alexander's strategy writ large and what his mission was within the NSA, was what he's even described as this sort of collect it all philosophy of, like, trying to make NSA a collector of huge amounts of information to try and predict terrorist attacks, to try and stop hackers. It was just sort of, a centralizing of authorities in one place that I don't think is really called for by the nature of the threat. And there's also, you know, the issues that attend any set of operations by a secretive intelligence organization whose work is almost entirely classified, and where transparency is not something that they are used to, at least not public transparency beyond, you know, the oversight committees. I just think that there was and I describe this in the book as kind of a power grab, really, by Alexander at the time to make NSA the center of the action in cybersecurity. And look, there are good reasons why NSA needs to be out in front in terms of the government's efforts to protect its own networks. I mean, that is its mission, is to protect critical classified information in the military and in the intelligence community. And there's no denying that NSA is where our best information security specialists, our best hackers, our best defenders, and our best offensive folks are working. But, you know, I think that as I write in the book, there was this sort of, you know, collect it all kind of, you know, land grab, I think, that Alexander executed. And I don't think that was good both for the agency, nor do I think that it necessarily prepares the country any better for dealing with the threat. And that's just not me talking. I mean, I'm persuaded of that view by a number of people who hold it as well. But yeah, that's where I came out in the book, for sure.
Okay. I guess I want to press on that a little bit. Did he do anything wrong? I mean, did you uncover any what we would call malfeasance, misfeasance? I mean, we're all familiar with the metadata collection, but that's a little hard to characterize as misfeasance when it was, you know, approved by a court. So did you find any sense in which this redounded to the disbenefit of American citizens, or is it more of a strategic judgment that you're making?
Well, I think it's more of a strategic judgment, honestly. And, you know, we can have a separate discussion about the metadata program and the authorities that Alexander was given. And we should, you know, if you take something like the metadata program, there's been a great debate over whether or not members of Congress did or didn't know what the NSA was up to in that regard. But in many of the other programs that have been exposed by Edward Snowden. I mean, it's very clear that take the PRISM program, for instance. I mean, FISA was amended in 2007 and 2008 to specifically allow a program like that. And just because we didn't know that there was such a program and such an acronym doesn't mean that we didn't know this is what the NSA was doing. I think there's a strategy question. And look, I mean, there is a broader, debate about whether or not we should be vesting all of this authority with government. My first book was really more geared towards that question and the privacy issues. Keith Alexander did not break the law. His detractors, we sort of feel that he too often erred on the side of doing something because he could, even if it wasn't a great idea politically or from a policy perspective. That's not that unusual, frankly, from a number of people.
I was going to say, tell me about that one.
He's not alone. This is the way, maybe better to ask for permission than forgiveness. But I don't see any instance in which he was categorically breaking the law. I mean, even if ultimately, the 215 program, the metadata program, if the Supreme Court eventually decides that metadata is covered by the Fourth Amendment and a warrant, we're still debating whether that individual program was or was not legal. Most of the courts, it seems, have decided that it was. But I did not find, great malfeasance in that regard by Alexander.
So guilty of lack of wisdom and political sagacity rather than venality.
Yeah, exactly, which is not a new story in Washington.
No. So we're going to go to the lines in a few minutes, but I have one last question in this segment. I've got more questions in case the lines run dead, but one last in this section. As I was reading the book, I noticed buried in the middle a story about efforts to hack into Hillary Clinton's emails.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time I sort of noticed it, but of course that's lately become a bit more interesting to the world. So first tell us about what you found in the book, and then tell us what you think about the current controversy, if anything.
Yeah, no, it is. So it's so interesting you bring that up, because I'm actually writing a story today for the Daily Beast in which I'm going to pull from that chapter in the book. But what I found was that there were, when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, there was an incident in which members of her senior policy staff, one guy in particular who I write about, received an email message that purported to come from, or seemed to come from, his colleague who was sitting in, the next office, I guess one door over. And it seemed to vaguely refer to something that they'd been working on. There was an attachment in the email, but this person was not expecting to receive a message from his colleague, and he wasn't exactly sure why it was being sent. So he gets up, he walks next door, and he says, "Now, about this email you just sent me." And his colleague looks at him and says, "What email? I didn't send you any email." And what they discovered was that this was what's known as a spear phishing attempt. So this was an effort by foreign intelligence to get inside and get a foothold in the policy planning office. What would have happened, presumably, if he had clicked on that attachment, was that it would have installed a virus, a piece of spyware that would have given the sender an ability to see inside that computer, potentially move around in the networks, gather usernames, passwords. Very straightforward. This is how the North Koreans are believed to have gotten into the Sony networks. So they avoided that, but it really underscored the degree to which a senior U.S. official is always going to be, and our government agencies always will be, prime targets for spies, as they have been for centuries. And now it's true in the cyber domain. As regards, former Secretary Clinton's email system and her decision to use only a private email account and to house the equipment for that in her house in New York, the experts I've talked to about this in the past few days say it just put her at even more risk of being hacked. I mean, it's true the State Department's unclassified networks have been hacked before. It's been very difficult for state to get them out of there. But the question becomes, with Secretary Clinton's home system, would she even have known that she was hacked? Would it have been easier to get inside it? And once inside, even though she was, state says, not transmitting any classified information, there are plenty of things that you might have learned about her and foreign policy by being inside even an unclassified system. So, I think that given the degree to which she was clearly a target, it seems like she made herself more of one by using a home system.
Do we even know who provided the security for the system?
We still don't. I mean, there was Bloomberg reported actually the other day that there was encryption that was used on the network, but it did not have. It was using a generic certificate, which basically just means it was not as robust as it could be. It's still not clear whether they hired anyone to come in and actually do a really enhanced security job. And the reason it's unclear is because journalists like myself and others keep asking that, and State and Clinton's current aides have just not answered it. They're not answering that question, which leads me to suspect that the answer is no, they didn't really do anything special for security, but we'll see.
I'd be shocked to find that out.
Yeah.
So, Dean, if you're listening, it's time to open up the lines and ask any of the listeners if they have any questions for Shane.
Sure thing. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our experts today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone while we are waiting to see who might dial in here. Let me make a brief programming announcement about our Teleforum conference call schedule next week. We're going to recap this week's oral argument in Ohio versus Clark. That's a confrontation clause case argued in the Supreme Court this past week. We're also going to be discussing some limitations on speech. And in a third Teleforum, we will get an update on the latest goings-on at the CFPB. That schedule is somewhat fluid, so do check in on our website and monitor your emails for updates to that schedule. Today, of course, we're talking to author Shane Harris. The book, again, is At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. I don't see a question yet, Paul, but let me start off with a sort of an audience question. I don't know. Technically not a member of an audience, but I'm up in a passive state today. The title At War, I think my understanding is you're talking more about sort of a wartime maybe posture and looking at the role of the military. Do you get into something that I think has confounded the conventional war, the war on terror? Do you get into state actors versus non-state actors, and does that make a difference in the cyber world?
Yeah, I mean, I do, and I think I distinguish in the book between. I'm focusing mostly on state actors in the book, insofar as I write a lot about espionage and what other governments are doing to stand up a military component for cyber, and then of course what the U.S. government is doing. But there is a distinction to be made when it comes to cyber crime. So I mean, if we're talking about cyber fraud or bank fraud or financially motivated crime, that is a law enforcement matter, and we do have laws that can address that and deal with that, and the FBI takes the lead in that. But I think where the lines get really blurry is what happens, and this is a great example with North Korea, what happens when a state decides to attack a non-state actor, or in the case of Iran, launching denial of service attacks on banks. And there, the water really gets muddied, and the question becomes, from the government's perspective, what is our policy response going to be to this? And it's why, I thought the Sony case was so interesting for a number of reasons, but one of which was this was an example where, the administration decided to respond with national power, in this case economic sanctions, to a hack on a private company. And by the way, an event that was in and of itself not all that dissimilar from what happens every day. Information gets stolen all the time by foreign agents. This was unusual in that it involved a Hollywood film and it involved threats of violence at movie theaters that showed it, although I don't think those were credible threats. Some data was destroyed. That's a bit unusual, but by and large, there were a lot of aspects of the Sony hack that were frankly pretty run-of-the-mill. It just got extraordinary publicity. It was also a case where we had very solid attribution, meaning, the government had a very, very good idea and were very confident of who did it. So in there we saw, the the government deciding to respond to this, I think that sets something of a precedent. And the next time there's a significant event, an attack or an intrusion or a theft at another company, I think they may turn to the government and say, well, what are you going to do about this? I mean, you kind of responded to Sony. Is there anything that you plan to do in this case?
Yeah, Shane, let's actually follow up on that. And let's rerun the Iranian bank attacks today,
mm-hmm.
post-Sony. Do you think that the administration policy has changed and that they're either willing or obliged by precedent to now act in a different way in response to that? I would submit that the bank stuff had a great deal more significant economic effect than Sony, albeit less public.
Yeah, I think, you know, look, if you're trying to make consistent policy here, the question that certainly if that bank attack happened today in a world post-Sony, my first question as a journalist to the National Security Council would be, why aren't you responding to this? You know, Iran is a rogue actor. It's been defined in terms like North Korea. It is a heavily sanctioned country already. It has made no bones about the fact that it's building an offensive cyber capability to harass the United States and U.S. businesses. I mean, it really kind of categorically is very similar if you go down the list to North Korea. So if you were being consistent about policy, one would expect that, yes, there would be some kind of repercussion in the form of sanctions or new sanctions. Politically speaking, I think the administration probably would find it very difficult to do to Iran what it did to North Korea, because we have an ongoing series of nuclear negotiations. It is the policy of the administration to try and, to some degree, I think, work towards not only just a deal, but trying to maybe normalize relations, although that's quite far off with Iran. There's a more active set of hopeful policies towards Iran than there are towards North Korea. And I think that while it's doubtless the case that the administration created policy and created a set of expectations around North Korea, around responding to cyber intrusions when it came to North Korea, I think it's also the case that it was very easy to respond to North Korea. We had very good attribution, and nobody's going to shed a tear if we sanction North Korea. It's pretty much an outcast country, and there's no policy complications to sanctioning North Korea. Not true when it comes to Iran.
So it's okay to beat up on the sniveling little kid in the corner.
Right, exactly. I mean, there's just really no consequence to it. And there was North Korea's internet suddenly went out a few days after President Obama publicly identified them as being behind the Sony hack, and there was some question of whether or not the Chinese did that, maybe as a favor to us and to slap down Pyongyang, because Beijing is not too happy with them right now either. It would be much more, I think, difficult for us to respond to an interactive cyber aggression by Iran right now, which is not to say that the administration wouldn't do it, but it would be more complicated.
How are we doing on questions, Dean?
We do have a couple questions.
Good.
Let's check in with our first listener of the day.
Hi, thanks. This is David Tryon in Cleveland, Ohio. And this might be a little bit off what you've been discussing so far, but let's see what thoughts you have on it. So there are concerns by normal everyday citizens that our own government is monitoring our emails and our web browsing, and people are uncomfortable with that. Are there ways to avoid that? For example, I've heard of this Tor network that supposedly you can avoid that monitoring, and I don't know what else is out there, and I don't know if it's really possible to do so, but I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Tor is certainly one way to ensure that it's much, much harder for governments to find out where you're physically located when you're on the internet. The downside of Tor is that it makes the web browsing experience extremely slow. But if you are, if that's something that you want, particularly if you're an activist or you're someone in a foreign country trying to evade detection, that can be a very useful tool. I think it's undeniable that the Snowden leaks severely damaged the relationship between Washington and Silicon Valley and have led to technology companies implementing encryption a lot more aggressively. So, email providers encrypting by default now more often their commercially available email programs. Apple now famously putting encryption on the new iPhone 6 such that it makes it impossible for the company to give the government the key to unlock the physical device, which is not to say that they can't get information stored in Apple servers. But these layers of extra protection that are being put out are very much, I think, a response to that surveillance and to the revelations of it. And we're seeing the government push back against this. Both FBI Director Jim Comey and Admiral Rogers, who runs the NSA, have said that things like commercial encryption being put on the iPhone and any other increased use of encryption is going to make it harder for them to do their jobs, harder for them to catch bad guys, harder to ensure national security. We had this debate in the mid-1990s over encryption, and we're sort of having it again right now. But at the same time, you know, look, I think that people have, I do think, some inherent right, maybe. I'm in a room full of lawyers. I don't know if I should start, you know,
it's
arguing what
the
rights are. Yeah. But, I think, you know, there are tools out there that are available to you to protect your communications, and I don't see a problem with law-abiding citizens using them. I mean, I use encryption in my work as a journalist, for sure.
I'm just curious if they're effective.
Well, you know, it depends on how you use them. I mean, you know, it's to use encryption well, you have to use it consistently. We definitely know from the Snowden documents that the NSA generally regards messages that are encrypted as being something that it would like to take a look at. So does using encryption maybe make you more of a target than you would be before? There are effective tools out there. They are not foolproof. And also when you're using encryption, you know, you want to make sure that you're using strong encryption. But generally, yeah, I think that they are effective and, you know, can be also helpful in protecting your information from, you know, protecting from criminals and, you know, and others, not just the United States government.
Shane, why don't you tell a little bit the story from your book about the NSA's efforts to penetrate Tor?
Yeah, so this is again something we learned from the Snowden documents principally as well, but you know, Tor is this system that essentially routes your traffic in such a way that it is virtually impossible to try and find out where you're physically located. The military actually helped develop Tor through the Navy years ago, and the State Department has actually encouraged democracy activists and dissidents abroad to use it as a way of accessing the internet and getting their message out and getting information from beyond sort of the firewalls of their own country. But what we found is that NSA, realizing that criminals and terrorists and other nefarious folks as well could be using Tor, tried to develop a way to physically identify people inside the network, trying to essentially break the magic that makes Tor, Tor. What was interesting actually in this case is that they seem to have largely failed at that, that Tor apparently works so well that it was just really technologically impractical to try and identify the people who are using it. But I love the example of the NSA trying to break Tor while the State Department is promoting Tor, because it sort of gets at the fact that we often in the national security and the foreign policy arena have competing policy objectives within our own government. And that's true in many, there are many examples of that, not just this one.
We still got a couple questions pending, Paula. And a reminder to the audience, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call here.
Hi, this is Kurt Levy at the Committee for Justice. When I first learned about cyber attacks, I just thought it was limited to, stealing information, damaging information, disabling networks. But then, you know, when there was the Stuxnet attack on Iran several years ago, where, if I understand correctly, they actually damaged the centrifuges, they caused them, I think, to spin out of control, if I remember correctly, I realized it can be used to actually do physical damage to machines. And I'm wondering, to what degree are we susceptible to that, to having, machines or other facilities disabled, blown up if they, you know, happen to contain fuel? I suppose in the worst case, you know, the attack against Iran was against nuclear uranium enrichment facility, I mean, could you wind up, you know, having some type of bad nuclear accident caused by a cyber attack? So I realized, you know, that the Stuxnet virus that was used was very sophisticated and not something that's easily repeated, but you know, I assume it's going to get easier and easier to do something like that. So to what extent are we vulnerable to that, and to what extent are we doing anything about it?
Yeah, and you did describe the Stuxnet attack correctly. I think we are vulnerable to it. I mean, to the extent that, you know, it is technologically feasible for a hacker to discover weaknesses in a network that gets inside the computers that control industrial equipment and cause damage, that's not just something that we know how to do. You know, I think it's a capability that most experts, I think, would say that the Chinese probably have, the Russians have as well. The Israelis certainly have that capability. Whether the Iranians and the North Koreans have it is debatable, but the learning curve is not so steep that they couldn't develop it eventually, or perhaps hire somebody on the black market to do it for them. What I found interesting about that whole scenario is that it's one that does get trotted out by policymakers as a way of, you know, grabbing the attention, some might say scaring people, to try and get more attention and more spending on cybersecurity. Understandable. But I think when you really drill down into the likelihood of it, it falls into a category that security professionals would say is low probability, high impact. So it's not likely to happen. If it did, it would be really bad. What I thought was interesting is, I guess it was about a week and a half ago, Jim Clapper, who's the Director of National Intelligence, was giving his annual global threats briefing, this time to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And he actually took this issue on and said, and this was a real departure from previous statements, even by Clapper, but notably by other officials, that the cyber Armageddon, as he called it, scenario, whereby a country or a rogue group takes out a key piece of infrastructure that causes massive damage, maybe even death, is no longer the scenario that intelligence officials are most worried about. And I think the reason for that is that, number one, he is seeing a much larger number of lower-level attacks, economic attacks, theft, intellectual property theft, cyber espionage, and that the cumulative effect of that is adding up over time. And the second reason I think that they're maybe less worried about it is, if there were an attack of that nature and we were able to attribute it to a country, which we probably would be able to do, I think, there would be military response involved to that. And I think that there's a sense among intelligence officials that you can't count it out, but that countries are learning and realizing that a massive infrastructure cyber attack like that would be treated as tantamount or effectively an act of war, and that we would respond to that not just in cyberspace. So we may be seeing a little bit of a development of a deterrence strategy or doctrine, frankly, which probably is a good thing. I mean, the more that we can deter countries from launching those kinds of attacks, the better. That said, we've launched them, you know, so it's kind of hard for the United States, as the country that did Stuxnet, to necessarily be preaching that other countries shouldn't be building those capabilities too.
Do you think we've done it more than once, i.e. Stuxnet just one of many?
That's a good question. I would not surprise me, let's put it that way. That said, I do think that a mission like Stuxnet, a mission like Stuxnet requires presidential sign-off. I think that if there have been other incidents of that, they're probably few in number.
Thank you.
We've got one question pending at this point. Probably have time for other questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call now.
This is Jack Park. Thank you both. My question kind of springs off the last two questions, or the last question in the response, and I, recognizing it's low probability, high risk, is for the private sector, should shareholders of companies push their boards to take defensive measures, or to outline strategies for protecting the company's assets and obviously that doesn't work with public facilities because they don't have shareholders, but I guess that's my question. You know, the utilities and other companies like that.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and it's actually one that I have been kind of asking both myself rhetorically and then also just asking it directly of people I interview. You know, is there a do companies have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders to protect their networks? I mean, I think the answer could arguably be yes. If you and there's clearly a fiduciary responsibility when it comes to how the company is managed. Are you taking actions that are in the best interest of the shareholders to increase profits, to manage the company responsibly, et cetera? You know, if China is stealing your trade secrets and making you uncompetitive, or is stealing negotiating points from you that puts you at a disadvantage when you go overseas to try and do business with your counterparts in China, and you know that's happening, and it's going to the bottom line of the company. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but it sort of plays out to me in my mind is it does seem that there's potentially some link there. You know, if we had if privately owned companies were leaving their physical facilities vulnerable and were getting physically robbed or vandalized on a daily basis, I think shareholders would have something to say about that and say, why on earth are you, if you're Home Depot, which I think is a publicly traded company, and you know, and you're not guarding the storefronts and people are coming in and robbing cash registers on a regular basis, the shareholders would have something to say about that. Well, Home Depot was compromised in a massive way by hackers, and I'm sure it's materially affected the company's bottom line. I guess I don't know whether the SEC would do something about that. I'm a little surprised that there haven't been, and maybe there haven't, and I'm just not aware of it, attorneys who have brought suits, maybe even class action shareholder suits, for that very reason. But I would imagine that somebody's going to think of doing that at some point.
I'm going to step. This is Paul here. I'm going to step out of the interviewer role and just add a little factor. The SEC, Jack, recently started requiring publicly traded companies to disclose material cyber risks as part of their K-1s. Okay. That requirement is pretty much in its infancy. I think they just announced the first set of audits against that in the forthcoming calendar year, this calendar year now. So the more that becomes a reality, the more likely it is that shareholders will demand accountability from the boards of directors. Likewise, the more that regulated utilities are called to account for their cybersecurity by their regulators, by FERC or their insurance commissioner of Alabama, the more that people will demand that as well. I think that the last piece, which is probably the one that will not happen anytime soon, but will drive a lot of this, would actually be consequential damage third-party tort liability to people who are injured by cyber failures. And if that comes about, then shareholders will rightly, I think, demand action and will build a whole tort the system with all of the insurance and audit and compliance requirements that come with it.
Thank you both.
Let me make one more call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone now. We've got a few minutes left here, and our lines are wide open.
Well, if nobody else has one, I'll ask one. But
we do have one more audience.
Good, then I'll let it go with that.
We have two now. So
there you go. So we definitely...
Here we go.
This is Alec McCausland calling from Phoenix, Arizona. I wanted to ask, are these networks so embedded in our systems, for instance, our power grid, that it would be impossible or very difficult to isolate the relevant equipment from the internet?
That's a great question, too. I think the answer to that is no. It would not be – it's not inordinately difficult. It could be challenging. But when we're talking about critical infrastructure here, power grids, public utilities, sort of big systems, I think that the owners and operators of those facilities conceivably, yes, could figure out where the vulnerabilities and the weak points are, where the connections are, and secure those and possibly even disconnect them. Where this gets a lot trickier, though, is if we sort of step back and we start talking about what's often called the Internet of Things. So as people in their homes, for instance, start, you know, attaching devices in the home, your thermostat, possibly even your refrigerator, your lights, to systems that allow you to remotely control them or that are transmitting data to a server to manage your systems in the home, that I think becomes much more enmeshed and kind of fundamental and a lot harder to control and regulate. But I think that when you get to, when you're talking about big facilities, which are regulated entities in many cases, it seems to me that it's much easier to harden and protect those. And frankly, the military has a lot of experience with doing this as well, in segregating classified systems from the, limiting internet connections for sensitive information. I think that same principle applies to big facilities too.
Paul, it looks like our last question has disappeared for the moment, so maybe that last question belongs to you if you have something you want to ask.
Okay. I was going to ask, Shane, what you think the future holds. Hmm. Where do you think this should settle? What should be the ultimate way of allocating security responsibility? You decry the rise of the military internet complex. So obviously, I think where we are now is not good. Where should we go?
Yeah. I think it's going to depend a lot on sort of two big factors. Where I think we should end up, I should say, as a general principle, is companies doing much more to protect their networks and their customers, the people who use their products and their services, and to some extent realizing that, you know, security is a service that you provide to people, particularly if they're paying you. I say in the book too, I'm not saying that we should be getting our military out of the cyber warfare business. I mean, I think cyber as a domain is real. Cyber warfare and cyber espionage are here to stay, but we need to have much clearer sort of lanes in the road for what the military does, what the intelligence community does, and I think generally speaking, you know, restrict the I guess what I largely pin on Alexander's philosophy, this kind of temptation for the military to come in and try and, you know, operationalize cyberspace domestically and sort of say that all of it kind of falls under their umbrella, which I should add, by the way, I don't think is the philosophy of the current NSA director. But yeah, I mean, people take it, but ultimately also people just taking a lot more personal responsibility. I mean, we need to get to the point, and it's been said by others, not just me, where, you know, we're educating people about how to behave in this space, and we need to have the equivalent of looking both ways when you cross the street and, you know, washing your hands before you eat and all of these sort of basic, what people will often call cyber hygiene. That's going to come in time. People are going to start to treat this domain properly, I think, with the risks and, you know, that are attendant to it. But yeah, I really did come down at the end of the day in the book of saying that this is largely a responsibility that's going to fall to private actors, possibly working in partnership with the government. But this is something that's more of a kind of a collective responsibility, if you like. The challenge is too big to just designate it to a government agency to take care of, and I don't think that would be, you know, wise policy in an open society anyway. So a lot more education, but I think it's going to come at the expense of a lot more bad things and a lot more victims. We're going to be seeing still more and more stories of companies being hurt and individuals being affected by this before I think we kind of collectively get it, if you like.
Paul, do you have a final thought before we adjourn?
Well, only that it's a great book. If you're listening this much, you've obviously learned that Shane's a great raconteur as well as a wise analyst. And I always learn something new reading his books, even when he doesn't cite me. So I'd recommend it as a Kindle download to just about anybody.
Well, sounds like we end where we began. My thanks to both of you, Paul Rosenzweig and author Shane Harris. The book title, again, At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. I want to thank you both for sharing your time with us today and your insights. Also want to thank the audience for joining us. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleform conference call is a recap of the Ohio versus Clark case. That's Monday at 12 noon Eastern time. But until then, next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.